Good morning. The April 10th meeting of the local government subcommittee will come to order. And let's see, Representative, would you like, have you read the minutes?
I approve them briefly.
Where are the minutes? I'll move the minutes.
Okay. Representative Freiberg moves the minutes. All those in favor of approving them, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes stand approved as written. Thank you very much. First on our docket today is Representative Elkins. And would you like to proceed,
yes,
please?
I would like to move
Okay.
And
proceed.
I can explain a little bit more of the background. This bill was originally heard originally introduced as House File 1358, so 2808 is a clone. It turns out in many cases it's easier to just clone a bill than to move it out of a finance committee through the various stops over to a policy committee like this one. When it was originally heard as in state government finance on February 28th, it was a very simple one paragraph bill, just making an appropriation. And it was laid over for inclusion in the state government finance bill under the condition that I came back after convening the stakeholders to develop a governance structure around the awarding of the grants. And so in HF 2808, as it appears today, it establishes a website, a accessibility grant council that includes representatives of the League of Minnesota Cities, the Association of Minnesota Counties, representative from the Minnesota Council on Disability, one member of the public who is a self-advocate, and that will probably be Noah McCourt, who brought me the bill originally. And a designate of the State Chief Information Officer, which will almost certainly be Jay Wyatt, the head of the Minute Accessibility Group. Because of the involvement of local government officials and because the purpose of the grant is to assist local governments in making their websites more accessible, we are here before the Local Government Committee today. The appropriation and the language in HF 2808 has been included in the state government finance omnibus bill.
Okay, thank you. Are there any testifiers?
If there are questions, Cody Olson from the Minnesota Council on Disabilities is here, but I don't think we need additional testimony unless
members. Are there any questions? Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Elkins, can you just give us a little bit more information on defining how websites will become more accessible? And what are they trying to achieve that the cities need help with on designing their websites?
It's kind of a specialized skill. The Minnesota Council on Disabilities publishes four principles of digital accessibility, which they refer to as perceivable. So can users perceive the information? So a key thing, for example, probably the best example, is that you want your website laid out in a form that is easily scanned by a screen scraper, basically, that can take the text on the website and present it orally. For example,
okay,
that's probably the best and most common example is that it needs to be accessible to a screen reader, which can convert it from written form to audio form for the blind, for example.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, the internet and the websites have been around for quite a while. Why is this bill? Is there a big demand for this? I'm not sure. I hadn't heard much of this before. I understand that, you know, it sounds like a well-intended thing. But
it means that Noah hasn't visited you yet, so I'm going to sick him on you. yes, it is a big issue. So there just aren't that many people who really know how to do this well. There is an accessibility office within MNIT that is able to offer support. At the Minnesota Council on Disabilities itself, there is a One guy, Chad Miller, who helps out, but there just really isn't enough resources right now to satisfy the demand. And it's my hope with this bill is to have some of the cities who receive the grants do it in a way that it can be serve as an exemplar, a template for other cities can easily copy it, so that it just isn't just a one-off program. We want to use this to provide funds for cities to learn how to do this and share that what they learn with other cities and counties.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the intent of the bill. A couple of concerns more. I think this bill is already in the State Gov Finance Omnibus Bill. Is that my understanding?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so we're kind of doing this backwards, Madam Chair. Thank you.
We are. I will readily acknowledge that.
Yeah. I don't know what it is. This committee, Representative Freiberg, it just kind of baffles me a little bit how we're kind of going backwards on the process, but I'll stick to the bill here for this.
Yeah, I just need to get Mr. Representative Kazi. It's mostly that we've got a bunch of freshmen carrying these bills who don't know all the rules yet, so we're learning in the process.
Well, I can appreciate that, and there's, I'm not going to go to the procedure on that much, but it is backwards, and the public's here, and I appreciate that it brought it back to this committee. After we were kind of done with bills, but we're happy to meet. Unfortunately, we got a couple scheduling conflicts, but the process is that's crazy. I don't think it's because of freshmen. It's there's enough senior members. I'm not going to get into that there. I am interested in the intent of your bill. So we're appropriating $100,000 for each of the next 2 years. Is this an appropriation that's going to continue to be going forward in other bienniums that you anticipate?
I
know that this bill, but is this a need that's going to continue to, that the state will continue to need to fund going forward?
I would like to think, Representative Kosnick, that, Madam Chair, that if we can create some good templates out there that that other local governments can copy, that eventually the need for this should go away.
And thank you, Madam Chair, if I can, and Representative Elkins. I think that's a good model that, if something's new, create a model and share it and kind of it becomes best practice and the hand of government doesn't need to be involved. But as I mentioned earlier, that the Internet's been around for a while. Websites have been around for a while. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of curious why different cities and units of government haven't already figured out a way and that there isn't a template, and why the state is continuing to pour money into it where cities have not already done this kind of is interesting to me. But you're saying this is just a one-time for this biennium funding?
Representative Elkins.
Yes, Representative Kosnick, Madam Chair, that right now the appropriation is just for this biennium, and there is a requirement in Subdivision 3 to report back to the legislature on how the money is being used. And so we'll be able to evaluate whether the program is meeting its goals before deciding to fund it for future biennials.
I appreciate the answer, Madam Chair. Thank you. It's my understanding that it's going to be an ongoing appropriation built into the base, I think, under the
I think there
the
might
state
be,
government.
I think there is in the in what I've seen, but again, we'll be able to evaluate it before we decide whether to continue funding it.
Yeah, I don't know if
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you. I don't know if Representative Chair Freiberg wants to comment on that. I believe that's his bill, that it would be an ongoing built into the base, or.
I'm chair of government operations, not state government finance.
Okay. Okay.
It does, just looking at the language, it does say. It doesn't mention the tails. It just says 100,000 in fiscal 2020, 100,000 in fiscal 2021 on line 2.22. So I guess I read it as just a two-year program.
Yeah, I would.
Yeah, maybe we could have Madam Chair, the staff, I think, has a little input and that's, on this topic if they have.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Ms. Dyson, do you would like to illustrate or give us some
guidance?
Guidance over here.
Madam Chair and Representative Kosnick, when the base for a statutory program is set with the second year of the biennium appropriation, and so the $100,000 in the second year of the biennium that's in this bill, there's a presumption that that's a base for a program, and I don't think the bill says that it's a one-time appropriation. That could change. but I think this does create an ongoing program.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I do believe that, on the spreadsheet, budget spreadsheets, I have seen tails for this program there.
Okay.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Elkins, as our conversation here sounds like you intend it to be kind of a one-time appropriation, and I think that's much more palatable. Maybe we could do an amendment here and make it a one-time appropriation.
Representative Elkins, are you open to that?
Sounds like that would be agreeable.
So Subdivision 3 does require a report to the legislature by January 15th, 2020. So we will definitely be reviewing the results early and often. I intend to be an ex officio or informal observer of this whole process. I've promised the Minnesota Council on Disabilities that I would work with them on an ongoing basis on these types of issues, including possibly working this summer with them on possibly even revisions to that section of Chapter 16 that relate to digital accessibility to see if those provisions in the current law can be simplified in a way that it makes it easier for local governments to comply.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, in Subdivision 3, it does say and annually thereafter for the report. And so that's a little bit of my concern. And, you know, going from our conversation here, I think if we could could we make an oral amendment, make it a one-time appropriation? And my concern isn't to the intent of your bill, but just kind of the ongoing cost and growth of government that I think we can all appreciate. And so if we could do maybe an oral amendment here, and staff could help us on how we would make it a one-time appropriation, I would make that motion.
Okay, thank you. Representative Freiberg first.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I don't see the need to do that. I mean, even if this is a continuing appropriation, it seems like a good program just to ensure accessibility of websites. I know I've spoken to Mr. McCourt, and I know he's had a lot of issues with the local websites in his area. And on top of that, we're not a budget committee, but I guess, you know, personally, I don't, you know, if Chair Nelson decides he wants to put this in his bill, I would defer to his judgment. I don't see a need to change this myself, but I guess I'm interested to hear what other committee members think of that.
Ms. Dyson, were you going to help out here?
Madam Chair, Representative Kosnick, to incorporate the one time, it would be on page 2, line 24, after the period, insert, this is a one-time appropriation.
Mm-hmm. So
Madam Chair, that would be my motion.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the conversation that we had here earlier is with the bill author, that that's what his intent was. It is the job of this committee to kind of vet these things out, and as I understood the bill author, and I think it would just certainly doesn't prohibit us from in the future doing it, but as we've kind of talked about, I think there's probably already best practices on websites that cities and townships could be incorporating, and so I appreciate the intent of the bill, and I think this just is a little bit better government and would conform to the bill author's intent to make it a one-time appropriation. So that would be my motion, Madam Chair, to add, as stated on line 2.24, after the period, these appropriations are one time? No? Or maybe I could have staff help clarify
question
that.
I have a question, too.
We probably have the same question. Elkins, did you want to?
Yeah, Matt, I just, a question for staff, I think, is there a path for us to get this into the state government finance bill?
Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, the same amendment would have to be made to the state government finance bill. I don't know the status of that bill at this time, but that would either be in Ways and Means or on the floor.
I think we adopted it last night.
Yeah, it's
Representative Freiberg.
I think it still needs to get heard in Ways and Means and then on the floor. So, but my question was, do we have a 24-hour rule in this subcommittee for amendments? I forget that because I would think this would be a substantive amendment and not a technical one. I mean, it is going to GovOps tomorrow too, so we can certainly have this discussion there as well, assuming it passes through. I don't know. I guess I'd be reluctant to make this change without consulting with the chair of state government finance and so forth. But
well, Madam Chair, I think it's certainly within your prerogative, but as we've heard here today, that doesn't seem to be much opposition to the author's intent that was stated previously that this was just a one-time deal to kind of put a template together, and I think it's, you know, I don't have a problem with the intent of that, but I think it's just better government to do it as a one-time appropriation as was stated, and, you know, we can certainly amend it. If it goes into other bills, we can put that in, I think, in Ways and Means Friday, but, you know, that's the job of this committee, and I think that's a good avenue to pursue.
Madam Chair, could this be proposed as an amendment Elkins. That would be formally heard in GovOps tomorrow and meet the 24-hour rule?
Representative Freiberg.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine with me. We could certainly discuss it there as well. I wouldn't have a problem with that. That would give us time to check that, and also we wouldn't be bypassing what I think the 24-hour rule that this committee has.
Yeah, and my thought is, yes, I've been told that this is a substantive change, so this will be referred to GovOps for a hearing tomorrow, so that might be possible, just to make the change in that committee.
That request having been made to meet the 24-hour rule?
I think the chair might be able to waive that, or can turn it into a 23-hour rule, if necessary.
Okay, so is the Representative Elkins, does that sound like a
That plan sounds for? Like a plan that you know helps us get closer to observing the rules.
So, thank you.
And Madam Chair, if we were to, you know, if the author's willing to make that amendment on the substitute, the next committee stop, and just state for the, you know, what we're talking about here, that it's meant to be a one-time appropriation, I can work with that. I prefer to do it here. You know, that's, you know, the agreement here at the table now, but if we're going to do it later, that's fine too, but.
Okay, and I am on the Finance Committee, and I know it does have to go before Ways and Means as well. So I think there'll be opportunity to get the job done in a timely fashion. Are there any more questions of the members? Okay, and Representative Elkins, do you want to renew your motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll renew my motion that we refer House File 2808 back to the Committee on Government Operations.
Oh, okay. Okay, I apologize. Before we vote on this, Representative Kosnick, would you be willing to withdraw your amendment request?
Well, I would prefer to have the amendment have a vote on it if that's the chair's if you're permitting it, that, you know, I think that's what the intent that everybody's talking about right here. That's the author's intent. He stated that multiple times. It's in your prerogative to do that. I'd prefer to have it amended now.
Okay. Again, I've been told that it's a substantial change. So
okay.
I guess I'm more comfortable knowing that the author will do that in the next committee.
And so, then, Madam Chair, then you're on that committee, so then you'll be authoring that amendment for us? Is that?
I could definitely do that.
Okay. Well, that would be fine with me, and then I would withdraw the amendment.
Okay. Thank you very much, Representative Kosnick.
Yeah. Thank you.
Any more comments or questions from the members? Okay. We will now vote on House File 2808. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. You are ready to go to GovOps. Thank you very much, Representative Elkins. Next, we will have Representative Runbeck, House File 2066.
That's it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Runbeck, when you're ready, proceed.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. House File 2066 is coming in kind of backwards as well. It has been heard as an amendment in public safety, and they're very interested in having that on their omnibus bill, but as it was looked at, it really needed to be seen by local government and government operations. So appreciate the chance to hear the bill. Bring the bill. So it turns out, as I'm hearing from people, that it has a lot of applicability. A lot of cities are interested in this particular topic. But I'm going to let Chief Swenson give you the details of what we're looking for here in the bill.
Chief Swenson, if you'll proceed. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This legislation is, a product of a situation we had in Llano Lakes last year. We had an applicant for a business license for massage therapy. We conducted the background investigation, which we are authorized to do, which is narrowly focused to state criminal history checks only. Shortly after this business opened, we began receiving complaints and began a criminal investigation into allegations of prostitution, which we did determine was taking place and charges had been filed. During that criminal investigation, it was determined that had we run a national criminal history check, the business applicant in our city likely would have been denied that business application, and we would have afforded this opportunity for somebody to conduct prostitution in our community. Since this has taken place, we've had numerous other applicants that are closely aligned with facts in our original applicant. And some of these applicants have a history in other states, in which we are unable to determine if there was criminal activity in these other states. And so this legislation just is to address that loophole. We worked with staff at the BCA to draft this legislation and had it reviewed by the FBI to ensure that it would be meet their requirements for access to the national database. And the feedback we received from the FBI legal office was that if approved as drafted, it would meet their requirements, and they would grant access to the national database.
Okay, thank you. Representative Runbeck, I am going to move your bill to GovOps. Was that your intention?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. All right, do we have any questions of the testifier at this point? Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So cities are not allowed to conduct federal background checks now?
Chief?
Is that why legislation is required?
Chief,
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that is. The current law only allows state criminal background checks, not national.
Thank you. Representative Elkins?
It's okay for right now.
Yes, Representative Salk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I see that it came out because of a massage business was running a prostitution ring. Do you know what some of the reasoning behind, including, operating taxi service or a taxi cab or pawn broker or precious metal, why those were also included in this?
Chief Swenson.
Yes. So by FBI rules, Madam Chair, Representative, by FBI rules, it has to be narrowly focused. And so rather than saying any business applicant with a city that would trigger would give the city an option to do that, we went through and identified some business applications which have demonstrated or proven to be problematic for cities in their licensing applications. And so that's where that list derived from. I believe you specifically were asking about the taxi service or taxi cabs. That's just really to ensure if cities are licensing them, they have the ability to make sure that their community members are getting into a vehicle with somebody who does not have convictions in another state that would raise concerns for members of the public getting in with them.
Representative?
So for the conduct of the criminal background checks, federal criminal background checks, is there like a time period that they go back? Is it go back 30 years, 20 years, 10 years when you're conducting that background check? questions.
Well, if it's, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative, so the retention period for the federal database, I'm sorry, I can't speak to that, but when we run a check, it's would be at a computer terminal, and if it's in that repository, we would see that.
Representative.
That's a for now.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand the intent of this bill is the background checks for people who want to start these businesses, or is my understanding of that correct?
Chief.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, this is for applicants to conduct a business in a municipality. And so there are some municipalities that aren't licensing these, and there are some that are. And those communities that have chosen to license these types of business would be afforded the opportunity to do these federal checks, these national checks.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, well, that makes sense to me. I mean, we're talking massage parlors, people who are wanting to get into lawful gambling, you know, people who want to run pawn shops, and you know, I can understand some of that. My only heartburn with the bill would be to want to drive a taxi cab. You know, I think I can understand for, you know, keeping the bill in line for people who want to start these businesses, they're filing for the license or the permit to operate in the city or the county. I can understand that, but when you're getting down to the specific employee level, that's where I just have a little pause about this. And I say that because, you know, I would think a taxi cab would be something. You don't need a lot of training for this. I mean, you don't need a full secondary degree necessarily. So I would think that would be an occupation that people coming out of jail, coming out of being incarcerated, maybe they're still on probation or whatever, you know, I would think driving a cab would be an occupation that a lot of these folks could do, and I would want to hold somebody at harm who, you know, has done their time, has served their time, they've, you know, been rehabilitated, if you will. I guess I just have a problem with that we're getting down to the individual employee level, specifically for taxi cab drivers, when I think that could be an occupation where people, like I say, who don't have a lot of specialty training could pursue. And I understand your comments and concerns about wanting those people to be safe, the patrons of that cab company wanting to be safe. I guess I would just defer to the individual business owner of that cab company to be doing their background checks for their specific cab drivers, their specific employees. So just leave that as a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Did you want to respond to that, Chief?
Madam Chair, Representative, yeah. Related to the specific drivers, this legislation does not preclude anybody for any type of conviction, just merely enables local municipalities to get the information to make informed decisions about business licensing. And so it doesn't speak to not granting licensing or any thing like that. That would remain a local decision. This is just enabling cities to have the tools to make informed decisions on their business licenses.
Thank you. Response, Representative
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, just to reiterate my comments that we're getting down to the employee level. That's just where I get the heartburn, and I would prefer to leave that the option of running that background check up to the employer. So, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if this is a question for the bill author or for the testifier, but a few years ago we passed the Ban the Box law, which says, you know, when people are applying for a job, you can't ask about their criminal history. You know, the thinking was just that it shuts out a lot of people who may have had a conviction maybe 20 or 30 years ago. It affects people of color disproportionately, potentially. And that passed. I guess I'm wondering if this kind of is in conflict with that proposal at all. I mean, particularly with some of the issues that Representative Zhang and Representative Lean mentioned. If any applicant, you know, even if it's a taxi service or something along those lines, would, you know, just be shut out, even if they're, you know, fully rehabilitated, fully reintegrated into society and we actually want them to be successful, would this make it harder for them to do that? I guess I'm curious if anyone would have a response if that's to that potential concern.
Who would like to answer? Chief?
Madam Chair, Representative. I don't believe it is in conflict. Again, this is just simply a bill enabling cities to have this information. As it's related to the employment component, and talking with my colleagues at our city and some other municipalities, the reason why we looked at this is the example from our discussions was when we're hiring summer temporary help for playground programming. And these are typically college students that may have something that would cause our Parks Department some stress about placing them in a park with children where they're supervising children and not having an ability to have that information. So that's where that came from. I don't believe it to be a hurdle. For individuals, again, this is just an opportunity for local governments to make informed decisions and have all the information in front of them.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. Any response?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's not really any guidelines on the bill about how far back this would go or what types of things from the background check could be used to deny an applicant for employment, I guess, would be my concern.
Okay. Next, Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Ms. Dyson. In regards to line 1.18 and 1.19, would local nonprofit groups have to be under the same criteria that this bill, should it become law, when they seek a special license in that city to sell the Lions Clubs, Hockey Associations, the JCs, the Knights of Columbus, et cetera,
Madam
Ms.
Chair,
Dyson.
Representative McDonald, I'm not sure how to answer that question because if you start up on line 12, it's an applicant for licensure is someone who's asking the city or county for a license. So if the act that you're talking about requires a city or county license, then I think it does fall under that. But I would refer to others who know more about the gambling laws and what, because I don't know enough about the occupations you're talking about.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Well, just, yes, thank you, Ms. Dyson. I see the ambiguity there. Just wondering, though, in cities, so if you're going to open a bingo parlor, you probably have to get a license from the city, correct? Is that the current state statute?
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, I don't know.
Representative Rumbick? Just curious on that line there. I'm just concerned, really, I just have a question regarding the local nonprofit groups in the city, and should they be, do a background check on the group or an individual, the manager, or is this not even an issue in dealing with those lines?
I think the chief wants to take the question.
Madam Chair, Representative, so current practice for those cities that have chosen to license charitable gambling, they are currently conducting these types of checks already, and confined to just a state criminal history check. This legislation would enable those cities, if they choose, to do a national criminal history check in the same fashion that they're doing them now.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. And Chief, would that be what, for the organization or the person in charge of submitting for a license in that city for nonprofit gambling?
Madam Chair, Representative, so I believe that's specific to communities. They may have their own processes in place. I do know that there are communities out there that are just licensing the manager or doing that check on the manager, and it's also, I am aware of some communities that do it down to the individuals that may be staffing those booths and selling them, and so I believe there's communities can do go either direction with that within their communities.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Chief. And then lastly, a taxi service, operated taxi service, Lyft or Uber would be included in that title. Is that correct?
Chief.
Or staff or as well.
And Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, a taxi service is different from Uber and Lyft. Uber and Lyft in other areas of law are referred to as transportation network companies, TNCs, in the transportation laws. And so I don't know that this would apply to them. And I don't know that cities, I don't know if cities have the ability to license. There is a last biennium, there was a lot of work done on TNCs, and I don't recall the outcome of that, but it was setting in state statute the overall controls over TNCs, and I don't know if cities have the authority to license them. Do they? Somebody's nodding that they do have that authority. So I'm not sure that this would cover TNCs, since they are categorized differently from taxis, as I recall, but I would probably have to look into that further.
It looks like we have somebody in the audience that has background. Would you like to come to the table?
Sure. Staff, for just a minute.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Would you please state your name for the record and proceed?
My name is Zach Williams. I'm general manager of Blue and White Taxi.
Okay,
Madam Chair, representatives. Cities do license TNCs. Both Minneapolis and St. Paul, I believe Duluth, Rochester, so they have the ability to license them. But I'd just like to say I don't know why the state keeps making laws different for cab drivers and Uber drivers, because we all do the same thing. So you shouldn't be separating us out here at all. That's my opinion.
Thank you. Thanks. Representative McDonald, did you have any follow-up? Let's see. In that case, I think we are, Representative Elkins, you have something.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, just in general, I understand what the intent of this bill, and I'm generally supportive of it. The kinds of activities that are listed for this, for the most part here, are things that are licensed in the city that I come from, and for the most part, I'm not sure I agree with including taxi services in here. But otherwise, the other common characteristic of most of these things is that they are the kinds of businesses where a bad character might move from one state to another, basically run out of town in one state and set up business in another state. And I think that's what you're really trying to address with this bill.
Comment?
That's correct.
Yes,
Chief, please.
Sure.
Chief, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, yes, that is what we're trying to address, to make sure that we're doing a comprehensive background check so we know who is conducting these businesses or engaging in business in our communities.
Are there any more comments or questions? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It looks like line 1.18 would exempt charitable gambling businesses or the nonprofit gambling businesses. I know that was talked about just a couple of minutes ago.
Thank you.
Other than, yes.
I have a question of our staff. There seem to be several objections to including the taxis. Would that be considered a substantial change, or if somebody wanted to make an amendment? Change?
Madam Chair, that's a decision of the chair.
Okay. All right, to the members, I know several of you have mentioned the taxi service. Do you want to move it to deletion, or should we just go ahead and take the bill as is? Okay. Representative Lynn?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would defer to the GOP members if they feel that's acceptable.
Well, Madam Chair,
I
do have a little bit of concern. I share the representative's concerns, and I would defer to the bill author, but I wouldn't oppose if you made an amendment to probably strike line 1.2 and 2.1. You either got to take them out, or I agree, or include the transportation network companies as
I don't know which way the author would like to go, but I see the conflict in that. And
Madam Chair?
Representative McDonald.
Before the, I want to give the author the ability, obviously, it's her bill, but traditionally, doesn't a background check cost the city around $45, $50? So if you have Uber and Lyft, or if they are a part of this or not, it would be very expensive for a city should they decide to do this.
Good comment. All right.
So, Madam Chair,
Representative Runbeck.
Just talking to the chief, I mean, if we were to remove line 1.20 and 2.1, that would not be a huge problem. I don't know if there's anyone else, LMC or anybody, that has any opinions about it, but that would be okay. We would accept it. I mean, if we can keep the bill moving, that's really what the goal is here. So.
Okay, I have one question of the author. If we make a change here, right now we're scheduling you to go to GovOps,
mm-hmm.
and I believe it's Correct. Tomorrow. If we make a change here, will that mean you'd have to go back to public safety?
Well, my understanding is that public safety is going to allow it to be offered on the floor as an amendment on the floor with the author's agreement.
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah, I think that
Representative Freiberg.
Representative Runbeck responded to the question. I mean, I think the procedure would be similar to what it is on other bills. It's GovOps would just, you know, assuming we're okay with it does seem like there are still some issues just beyond the taxi cab issue. But assuming, I can't speak for how, you know, if it were to pass out of here and go to GovOps tomorrow, I can't speak for how the committee members there might necessarily respond to it. But assuming it were to pass out of there, I think it would just go to, the motion would be to send it to the general register. It might get grabbed by rules because it hasn't met deadline. But then at least, you know, if that all were to happen, and again, I don't know that that is a given, considering some of the issues that have been raised, but then it could be potentially offered as an amendment on the floor, and it would have been vetted by local government and GovOps. That is the process we're following with some of these other bills.
Okay, thank you, Representative. So do we have an official motion on the floor for the drivers? Representative Lee.
Madam Chair, my motion would be just to strike 2.1, just for the cab drivers. I understand the public safety concerns with the company operators, so my thoughts would be to leave that. If other members feel differently, they want to include the owners of the cab companies in taking them out of the bill, then I guess I'd be okay with that. But my concerns are mostly around the drivers.
So, Madam Chair, I would accept that as a friendly amendment. I think that
okay. Well, that works
job.
Then. And then we don't. You're accepting that we don't mm-hmm. need to vote on that, right? So then we can proceed yes. to. Are there any other more questions or comments? Is there anybody from the audience,
Madam Chair,
as well? Representative McDonald.
Just maybe staff could help. I think we still would need to take that vote, wouldn't we? Even if the author accepts it as a friendly amendment.
Okay. All those.
What actually one.
Come and get Representative Freiberg.
Yeah, I think you may just want Ms. Dyson to state what it is. There might be like a technical change also, like moving the or to the end of line 1.20.
Let's get out our pens.
Okay, if Ms. Dyson would state what we're doing.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the proposed oral amendment is on page 1, line 20, after the semicolon, insert or, and page 2, delete line 1. And renumber the remaining clause.
All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay, that stands approved. Thank you very much for taking that in. Oh, I'm sorry. There are people that want to testify in the audience.
Yeah, that was just the approval of the amendment, not the bill.
Yes. Okay. Hello, and if you welcome, and if you'd state your name, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ann Linson with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I will be brief. We don't have a specific policy in support of the language in this bill, except for the fact that it, of course, gives cities more tools to gather more information about entities and individuals applying for licenses within the city. So we, of course, support that. If you will allow me a little bit of latitude, I would be remiss if I didn't highlight one of the longstanding policies we have had that many of you around the table who have served in local government have dealt with, which is the lack of statewide regulation or licensure of massage therapists. And this situation that the chief brought forward is one of many. Every single round of our policy committees establishing our legislative platform, our cities come forward and say, please continue to work on statewide registration or licensure of massage therapists, because in lack of that, there is a burgeoning sex trafficking market within the state under the guise of massage therapists. There are many, many legitimate massage therapists. Do not get me wrong on that. But in the name of public safety and as an additional tool to our cities and our public safety departments, some partnership with the state on the regulation or licensure of massage therapists is something we continue to work on. So just potentially maybe planting the seeds for next session for a further discussion about that issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, are there any more comments, questions before we take the vote to move the bill? Okay. Okay. I'm sorry. But oh, Representative McDonald, I'm sorry.
Thank you. One question for Representative Rumbeck on that 2.2, the question for second-hand goods dealer. Would that be like an antique store or a once again removed kind of thing?
We'll have the chief.
Just curious as to why that was there.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is getting to those businesses, pawn shops, and the like. That's what we're hoping to include in that.
Okay. Thank you. At this point, I think what we're going to do is lay the bill over. I think we've got some issues that we need to address further. So,
Madam Chair.
Representative McDonald.
I would just encourage us probably to take the vote just because we did amend the bill. Everybody seemed to be agreeable. The author took the friendly amendment. We seem to be in the same page in agreement on that it's ready to be passed. So I would encourage you to take the vote and move the bill forward.
Okay. To try to be consistent, we'll do that then. Okay. I will move House File 2066. To government operations. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
As amended. All those opposed, same sign. Okay. You are free to go to GovOps operations. Thank you
thank
so
you,
much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee.
Thank you.
Okay. And next we will hear from Nick Thompson, who isn't from Metro. What? Oh, yeah. When I talk. Do that. Mr. Thompson, if you will identify yourself for the record, thank you very much for coming here today and proceed.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Nick Thompson. I'm the Director of Metropolitan Transportation Services at the Met Council. I thank you for this opportunity to give you a presentation of overview of the Metro Mobility Service Program. And I'm making the assumption that you all have the PowerPoint slides in your packets, and I'll be going through that today.
Thank you for having that. We obviously don't have a lot of...
We're going old school on the technology today, so... So I'll just refer to the slide number as I go through this so that tracking the slide number is up in the upper right-hand corner of the presentation. I think it's good to talk today about Metro Mobility. This is one of our most critical services that we provide at the Met Council. It's also a program that is not always well understood, and I think it's good that I have this opportunity to kind of just walk through how the program works the history of it, some of our challenges, and some of the new things we will be trying on this, and answer any questions that you have. I know it's very common for you to get questions from constituents, and so hopefully I can answer some of those questions too. What we think is most important to start off with, what is Metro Mobility? This is a public transit service. It's a shared ride service. Just for those that are certified to use the service, so those that are unable to use fixed route transit because of their disability that they're certified for. This is a service that is guaranteed as a civil right under the Americans with Disabilities Act. So it's a program regulated by the Federal Transit Administration. But in Minnesota, we've expanded on that. The legislature has expanded on beyond what the federal requirements are under statutory requirements, following 473.386. So it really expanded who can use it, a little bit how the service works, and most importantly, where that service exists in the Twin Cities area. This is a transit service for those that are certified, and it's a service that's for any trip purpose. There's no limitations on what your trip would be for this service. On the next slide, three, this is a program that has really been around for a long time and has went through many iterations, and I'll highlight a few. It started really as a pilot, as a lot of times we do with new services, back in the 70s. Became known as Metro Mobility in 1979. A couple key things is in 1990 is when the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed at the federal level. That changed how the government provides disability services throughout all types of things, but particularly a lot around transit services. And so it's the ADA law that really sets up how we provide this service. We've went through many different service models on how to try to deliver this service that is essential for the customers. The one that we kind of operate under today is started in the mid-90s. In 2006 is really when the footprint of where the services are that are provided was established by the state legislature. 2006, the state said that the boundaries of where we can provide this service are with the transit taxing district as it exists in 2006. And that's an important point because it's something you're debating at this legislature this year about should we expand those boundaries. Five communities have been added to the transit taxing district since 2006. Those five communities aren't able to have we aren't able to provide service to those communities just because of how the statutory requirements are. In 2015, we really realigned our service, partly due to some of the concerns of the customers about how it operated, but most importantly about efficiency. Raleigh's is a very expensive service to provide. We're always seeking ways to redesign it to make it more efficient and more customer-friendly. So in 2015, we really realigned our service, reduced the number of providers, the service areas, did important steps like trip could be a single trip for a customer. We didn't require them to switch buses at a service boundary. Some major changes in 2015, and we did see quite a few efficiencies and improvement in customer service then. Slide four is an important slide to understand really the two different types of services that we refer to in this model. We brand the program as Metro Mobility. We want the customers to understand that really there's one type of service, but we have different laws based on the service area. The light blue area is the federally mandated area for the service, and the gray area beyond that is the area that is the 2006 boundary for state level of service. So we internally call this the ADA and non-ADA area. The light blue is the area that really designs where your route should be, your service area is based on your fixed route transit service. And that's where the federal guarantees go in. It's roughly 3/4 mile from any of the transit, fixed route transit areas. So that blue area can change as we add and change transit routes in the region. So if we add a new transitway to a city like Eden Prairie, that would become an area that is now a federally mandated. So that blue area changes. The gray area would require state changes. But for the customers, we try to have them be similar. One of the key differences between those two is because it's a right in the federal required area, every trip is guaranteed on the blue area. So a trip made within that blue area, we cannot deny any trips, and that really defines our service model. In the gray area, we do have, there is some flexibility for the providers to deny a trip if they can, don't have the capacity to, though we try to not have any trip denials if we can, and our denial rate in that is very, very low. So a couple of things that define on slide five the differences between the federal and state area. There really is, you know, the goal is to provide mobility for those that have a disability that don't have another option for moving around. And I think that's very similar, though. The Minnesota state statute is really just trying to improve access to mobility. The certification, the Minnesota state statutes are really kind of silent on a lot of goals. And so you see the federal column on this page is really what guides a lot of our service design. But it's for those, we got to keep remembering that it's a transit service. So it's for those that are unable to use our regular transit is really who this is geared to. We, in our area, the driver provides escort services from inside, from door through door, which means if the passenger is being picked up at a building, the driver will exit the bus, go into the door, pick up the passenger, escort them to and onto the bus, and then when the trip is complete, escort them off the bus to their destination. So it's an escort service that is required. Passengers do have the right to not need that escort, but the drivers basically escort all trips. That no denial, no untimely, we have very strict service standards about how long a passenger can ride on a bus, how long around when the pickup could be, and so we must meet those federal requirements. Fare structure-wise, this is a more expensive transit fare. It can be no more than two times whatever your regular route fare is. In our region, we do not go to two times the fare, but it is a higher fare, which I'll talk about. And in the trip purpose, it's a service for those that are qualified for it. We do not at all consider what the trip purpose is. We will serve them for whatever trip they need in that service. What designs our service is both federal and state compliance. We have a mix of the requirements that really design that. Again, at the federal level, every trip must be provided. There are no denials. So that we must have capacity to serve every trip. So that drives some of the cost of your price, too, because you have to have fleet big enough to make sure that you always can meet capacity. On a day like today, I think we're on track to set a one-day record for the most number of trips. Tomorrow we won't have many trips. People are making their trips today if they can. But we have to meet today's demand for that trip. So we'll have probably 9,000 or more trips today. And so we always have to anticipate that. And that means we have to have the right number of buses to deliver today's service and the number of drivers to deliver that service. There's a lot of testing, background checks on the drivers. We want to make sure we have qualified drivers. We don't need a commercial driver's license, but they must pass federal drug and alcohol testing, screening, background checks. That's an important part, as I'll talk about later, about how we look at different services we might add to this. We have really good security. We know where the technology is in place. We know where our fleet is. We know where our customers are. We have cameras. We can do investigations. So we have really good systems to manage compliance with these. Slide 7 kind of talks a little bit about our organizational structure, which are kind of our service model. We've decided that we've kind of divided the risks of this service around our service design model. In the division that I'm responsible for, MTS, we are responsible for all transit services that we contract out to private providers. And Metro Mobility is the largest one of those. So all the trips are provided by private contractors. What we do at the council is manage the customer service end of that. We provide oversight of those contractors. We are the ones that certify that the customer has a disability, that they're qualified for that service. We issue go-to cards and IDs. We also provide emergency backup services. If one of the dispatch centers for the contractor goes down, if there's a communication issue, they can use our facility for emergency backup, and that does occur. And then we do investigations. Any customer complaints, we will manage those investigations to make sure that it followed through and there's no harm done to our customers. The contracted service center, contractors provide the drivers, they provide the rides, they book the trips, they are dealing with the customers about the individual trips, and they are make sure that they have sufficient service so that we meet our performance goals. So slide 8 talks about where we are, and you know, one of the pressures of this system is that it is a growing or a fast-growing system and consistently growing system. We spent $65 million, all state funding, it's a state funded through general fund in 2018, provided about 2.4 million rides. Our ridership is up 30% in the last 5 years, typically growing from 6 to 9% per year. And basically, it's 6 to 9% growth in ridership means 6 to 9% growth in costs. And so when rides grow, our fleet grows, the communities we serve remain stable. As you see on the subsidy, it is a very expensive service to provide. Over $28 per ride on average, which is our highest cost service that we provide. But if you can compare us to our peers, we're probably, I think, the second lowest cost per ride provider of an ADA service in the country. So we're providing it efficiently, but it's a very expensive service.
Madam Chair, I just had a question in regards to the fleet. Do you know what the average lifespan of one of these buses are? Yeah.
Madam Chair, committee member, yes.
Mr. Thompson, I'm sorry.
We generally try to have at least 175,000 miles on them, and roughly 5 years is our goal for life of these, and they typically are at the five-year point. They're ready to be replaced. They're exceeding often 225,000 miles on all. So we are replacing these vehicles every 5 years. There would be a demand to replace them even sooner, but we try to stretch out their life as much as we can. Versus a general bus is lasting 14 or 15 years for a big bus. So that's how you see a difference in a life service life of these this fleet.
Representative, any follow-up?
No.
Proceed, please. Thank you.
So who is our customers? You know, they use for all types of systems. We have, last year we served 26,000 unique customers. We have over 40,000 customers certified to use this service. We are processing about 800 new customers per month. So this is a growing customer base. It's a customer base that we think that roughly 40% of them are eligible using the trips for waivered services, and that's why there's a bill in the legislature this year about sharing information with DHS so that may the potential to recapture some of the costs of waivered services trips. One or three out of every 10 trips are somebody that is using the lift on the vehicle, so they have a mobility device that requires the lift. And these are trips that are typically 10 to 12 miles long. These are not necessarily short trips that are being made. Our contracts-wise, we've divided it into three. We compete these contracts on five-year terms. We have three demand. We have what we call demand contracts and agency contracts on slide 10. Demand contracts are the ones that you're pre-booking 1 to 4 days in advance. We have two major vendors that are providing those three service areas. And then we have an agency contract, which is we've remodeled this year. This is, just for efficiency standpoint, only serving day training and rehabilitation centers. That's one of our big customer cases. They have a kind of a unique business model where we pick up multiple passengers and deliver them to the same site. And so we found that through efficiencies in contracting, it's good to peel that off as a separate contract type. So it's a smaller CERN, but again, we contract out and compete those contracts. We find that we have 2 to 3 bidders typically for these contracts. It's in a good competitive model that keeps our price competitive. We also have added supplemental services into this on slide 11, and I'll talk a little bit more about some other ones we're considering this year. One of the frustrations for customers is this is a shared ride service that you must book in advance. And as you know in your daily life, you have trips you want to decide to make today. And so we wanted to provide an alternative for same-day trips where we can. And we call that supplemental. It's not required by federal or state law, but we think it's a good complementary services. So it's a taxi model currently. This is a premium, what we call same day, so you can call up and have a trip made if a taxi is available. We have a different pricing structure for the customer on these, where the council provides no more than $15 for the ride, and the customer provides the customer. The way the model works is the customer pays the first $5 of the trip, the council provide or the state provides the next $15, and if the trip costs more than $20, then the customer pays more, the extra above $20. What we find is that most of these trips do cost under $20. The customers generally are booking these for shorter trips, and it's a good model, and it's a good extra service that's available to the customers that choose to use it. This is a small, still a small share of our total trips, but it's one that we see potential to grow in the future, and we think it's in the right mix. It might be a way to make the system more efficient, provide better service, and keep some of our costs down. Our fleet profile on 12, this kind of looks at our actual buses. It's mostly the buses that you see on the street, what we call the cutaway buses. They're all lift-equipped. They all have cameras. You can pay in cash or your go-to card. The council owns this entire fleet. That's another way to save money. The contractors do not buy this fleet. The council buys this through a competitive procurement. And then we provide the fleet and the technology to the contractor, so that way our fleet is all the same. And the contractor, though, is responsible for maintaining those, keeping them well-maintained on schedule. And then they are retired at the end of their life and auctioned off. They do find some reuses in the area. Southwest Transit is using some of these for their prime service. Nonprofits use some of these as they're retired, and a lot of them are sold at auction and leave the state for other purposes. They're equipped with mobile data, cameras, fare payment system, and we use the state's radio network as part of this system for communications too. So thinking about it through the customer's lens, how a customer uses this service on slide 13, they are required to pre-book the service. So they must book at least the day before for their ride, so that we're taking 230, 240 reservations per month, our contractors are. What the customer does is they negotiate their trip time. So if you think about it in terms of a doctor's appointment or going to work, you may say, I need to be at an appointment at 4 o'clock. So they have a guarantee to be there at 4, and they're negotiating then when that ride may pick them up to get them there by 4. Or they can negotiate a pickup time, say, I want to be picked up at 4 o'clock. And so that kind of sets when the window would be for that. We try to book ADA versus non-ADA. They have the different requirements, the federal versus state, so that kind of determines we're required to book every ADA trip. The non-ADA, we may put them on standby if we don't have capacity. The customers have rules around when they can cancel, and if they have not ability to make their trip for some reason, something comes up, we have policies around whether they can cancel and be penalized for that. Our service hours are, the customer service hours are Monday through Friday, but if customer, to deal with their specific trip, and Madam Chair, I think I talked to you about this last week, and I might not have given you the correct information, but on the existing trip, if you want to find out where your bus is going to be there, where your fleet is, that's 24-hour service to the customer, to the contractor. The customer service, if they have a complaint, is more the hours that you see on this slide. So I just wanted to correct for the record that change from what I think I told you last week. So if you have a trip at 9 p.m. and you're wondering where your trip is, there is somebody that you can call at your dispatcher anytime and see the status of that trip via phone.
Okay, that's helpful. So as long as you've got the vehicles running, there is somebody your customers can contact.
Call, yes.
Okay, thank you.
And it's the same number that they call for requesting a trip, so it's a number the customers know well. It's the one to deal with their contractors. So, and they do call about, where's my ride, and all those type of calls are accepted. So slide 15 really gets to those requirements that we must meet. a couple of the performance measures that we meet, we look at on a daily basis. We have good data to provide this. Is, you know, what is our on-time performance as measured and defined federally? What is our performance for arriving at the appointment times on what's scheduled? And then on board time is, what is our performance? The customer is required about how long the trip can be. That's relative to how long that trip will be if you're riding on fixed route transit. It's very important to think that this is not comparable to your individual if you were to drive from your house to the doctor's appointment, how long that would take. It's how long would it take you if you were to ride a fixed route transit on that trip. And so we have requirements around that onboard time. Some of these trips can definitely get long relative to how far they are and share a ride, but we closely watch to make sure that our onboard time's performance is not exceeded. And these are very high performance targets. These are 95%, 90% targets. So these are aggressive targets set federally that we are monitored on and what must meet. So that really defines how big our system is, how many drivers, how many fleet we are to meet these very tight performance standards. This is a customer base that we listen to on an ongoing basis about how the service is working, how the service could change, and what some of their issues are. We hold two public forums each year, convenings, where we invite all our customers and providers that have customers or parents of customers to come, and just we listen to them. We have these convenings that typically have 100 or more of the customers or their clients that just come and tell us how the service is working, where we need to make improvements. We also have a monthly newsletter that advises customers of all the changes that may be coming. And then, of course, we have different ways that they can just talk with us, customer service representatives. This is a service that relies on partners. We have a Transportation Accessibility Advisory Committee at the council that really is made up of users of the system, agencies on the system, program leaders that really help take input from the public, from us, and guide us on shaping how this design of this system is working. Slide 18 talks about the legislative task force that was passed in 2017, passed the legislature. Independent task force that was made up of all the seven county commissioners from all seven counties in the metro area, nonprofits, agencies that deal with those with disabilities. Their goal was to identify what we should change in this program, looking for efficiencies, ways to minimize costs. I know the legislature was concerned with the cost growth, so they asked for this independent look. And some of the key recommendations we are moving forward with. This year we anticipate putting an RFP out that allow TNCs, as you've discussed earlier, and other taxi providers to expand on the system for on-demand services. We're hoping that they respond to that. We are looking at new technology investments that were recommended. One of the key of the task force was try to increase the flexibility to provide this service, different ways to meet the customers' just basic needs for mobility in different ways, and especially the on-demand same-day service, while at the same time monitoring costs. And so we're moving forward with those recommendations. We really appreciate that task force and the work that they did, and thank the legislature for directing that.
Thank you. Can I ask a question? What does someone have to do to be able to take advantage of this program?
Madam Chair, in general, they first have to be certified that they have a disability, and that disability does not allow them to use fixed route transit. And so that's a very rigorous process that has an application process, often requires a medical sign-off from a medical provider, and then we, on staff, put them through an evaluation at our facilities, and so they have to schedule that. And once that has been determined that they are certified, we issue them a Metro Mobility Card, and then they're part of that program. Typically, it's a four-year certification, depending on the disability. There's some that might be more limited, and we have a few that are almost permanent customers of that, but generally,
it's tied to the renewal of their state ID, and so on average, majority of ours would have to renew after 4 years to continue to use the service. There's no age requirement or anything like that, but it is a certification. You must be certified to use the service.
Thank you. We do have the room till 12:30, so I'm thinking we may go over.
Just have a couple more slides, and then I know that you probably have some testimony and more questions. So we are making major investments in technology as a way to continue to be more efficient, to do more dynamic routing, to allow customers, frustratingly, they cannot book online, they must call. Our technology vendor has not been able to provide online booking in a safe and secure way. We do hope to roll that out this year. That's a key feature that our customers demand and expect, and we want to provide. And so we're hoping to have that. We're looking at new technologies for the driver, for tablets, and just technology costs, bringing those costs down, but also giving us more flexibility. The service options I mentioned, we're looking at this more, TNCs, bringing them in, and other taxi services. The other one we're trying to do is encourage our customers to use fixed route transit more. We know that actually if we can encourage them and they can use it in certain conditions with their disability, it might actually be a better service for them. But we need to do things to encourage that. Number one, we're piloting a zero fare on the fixed route transit now, but also doing really aggressive outreach to understand what their concerns with using that are, and doing training and anything we can do to get them comfortable and feeling safe and secure in using fixed route transit. We're seeing some early success on that, but on a very limited pilot. But we think that's one good option that is a win for the customer, for some of the customers. Some customers will not be able to use fixed route transit. Others will be able to use it on certain days. If we can encourage that more, we think that's a better, in many ways better, because it's more frequent. Some of our services like light rail are just really good services that provide more flexibility. You don't have to book in advance. So we're encouraging that, but at the same time, it might reduce some of our demands on metro mobility and reduce our costs there. And the fixed route costs are much lower per trip than metro mobility. And so those are things we are doing this year. And lastly, I always want to end with why we are more than happy to provide this service. We hear it all the time. This service is essential service that we are for the customers. This provides mobility. It provides those the ability to get to work, to get to their appointments, to get to their entertainment. And without this, for many of our customers, they would have no transportation options. And so we are more than happy to provide this, and we really appreciate the state's support in allowing the service to even go beyond the federal requirements to meet our service. And we're happy to expand it to even more communities. It's a service that's essential to many, and we expect it to continue to grow. So with that, I'd close the presentation, take any questions. And
thank you. I think we've got a few people that I know wanted to testify. So I'm going to try to, and I've asked them to take like 2 to 3 minutes if possible. And if somebody from the audience, is there somebody that wants to come to the table to testify? If you would like to, okay.
I've got a couple of questions
meantime,
that maybe we could direct.
Representative
Cosney. Yeah, just and then the public could have a little more time to for their comments. I appreciate the presentation, Mr. Thompson. Obviously, being on transportation the last couple of years is something that I've worked on and have a special interest in for my district. A couple of the questions that you'd mentioned that I wasn't aware of previously, you'd mentioned that regular route service and expanding the light rail will increase your mandatory service area federally. Did I understand that correctly?
Madam Chair, Representative, that is correct. So wherever a fixed route service, not express, but fixed route all day, like light rail, and enters a new area, that changes our boundaries for the federal requirement. And so okay. I think expanding southwest to Eden Prairie is going to expand our service in Eden Prairie, for example.
The orange line would be another example that's near your area. That's going to be an all-day service, but I think we're already serving the Burnsville, but if Orange Line Extension were to go to Lakeville, that would change service, local service in Lakeville as an example. So every year we're kind of changing our service footprint of the federal,
okay.
And but some of those big transitways are expanding into new territories.
Representative Kosner.
If I could just quick follow up on that topic, do you how much expansion will be caused by the Southwest Light Rail? And I just out of curiosity, I thought most of Eden Prairie was already covered, but maybe not.
Madam Chair, Representative, the one big change I think will be the hours of service will be expanded, because Eden Prairie's Metro Mobility Service has limited hours, probably till 7 right now. Each community has different hours based on transit. So light rail, I have not seen the hours of service, but we'll match whatever the hours of service are for that. The other communities on that service, I think, are within the federal. So that's like one example. The Gold Line is another example. In Woodbury, we provide service in Woodbury today, but again, limited hours. I would anticipate when the Gold Line is open that Woodbury's service hours would expand, because the service hours of Gold Line will probably be broader than those of the current. So provide really expanded service for those customers that allow them to have evening jobs and mm-hmm. go to evening events, that our service doesn't extend to the evening hours in those communities today, and better hours on the weekends too.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, and Mr. Thompson, the expansion of the hours, that's federally required because of the regular route. That's not a state decision or Metro Mobility decision specifically. And that kind of leads into my second question, Madam Chair, if I may. On the non-ADA areas, or the state decided to do areas, do we have the ability through statute or just through Metro Mobility's decision-making to offer different levels of service to meet in the times of service that would make it a little less expensive and more realistic that we could offer communities Metro Mobility service such as Lakeville, but maybe not at different hours and such to get the service started and not be as expensive?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Thompson.
Representative, in the state area, we have a lot more flexibility on what the hours are. We kind of set a service model of for those communities where you don't have transit, so there's some similarity from a marketing standpoint. And we know there's demand for actually more hours than we have. So it's just actually the number of hours we provide is a financial decision, too.
Mm-hmm.
And the state gives us more flexibility, and if there's a desire to have more service, we can provide that. But there's just, as you know, there's a more hours, more cost. So we just would need a budgetary fix to that, too.
Yeah.
But we have more flexibility in the state area than the federal area.
Okay, that's kind of what I wanted to confirm and wasn't really discussed here, but the deficit operating within Metro Mobility is quite significant. And so that was kind of what my question with curtailing the level of service on the non-federal EDA-mandated portions is obviously that's something that you're looking at, but we'd like to provide the most amount of service that we can, but just trying to balance that out. And, for my particular district is, well, I think most people here know that we've been paying into the transit district without having the service. So trying to balance, I recognize that there's a cost with that, but to see if there's different areas to do that. How do you balance, the large deficit? I'm trying to remember exactly how much it is. It's like close to $60 million or somewhere around there. How do you balance the level of service and that with that continuing deficit?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we have a deficit, I believe, in the next biennium of $36 million. We're projecting that Metro Mobility will consume our entire base and exceed that base amount in the out years if their service model is the same. The federal is mandated service. We have no options for cutting that. The state service boundaries are purely a decision by the state legislature what those boundaries are and what service we would provide. We will meet those service areas as you want. We're happy to provide. We know there's demand in those areas and demand beyond that and demand for more hours. So that we see that as a decision, if you want changes to that discussion at the legislative level.
Has there been much talk about,
Senator,
thank you, Madam Chair, you know, with that large deficit of adjusting the service hours and levels of service to kind of offset some of that?
Madam Chair, Representative, we have not considered that at that point, but it's we have limited options in that model because a lot of our costs are on the federal side. Mm-hmm. But you know, those hard choices will have to be on the table in the future.
Okay.
We've cut transit, fixed route transit service to deal with the deficits in the past, and we have other services like TransitLink and others that have more flexibility for. We see this as an essential service, and we hope we don't have to make those hard decisions. So.
Okay. And then one final question. You'd mentioned the contracting with the transportation network companies, and that includes taxi providers service. You just talk a little bit more. It sounds like you're doing an RFP sometime this M19?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we are we're anticipating getting that out. We hope that there are responses. We are making sure that it's not limited to TNC. Taxis are definitely part of that. We already have taxis in our model, too.
Mm-hmm.
We anticipate that taxi model will continue even with this RFP. It's not replacement. It's an expansion.
Yep.
But we also we need people to respond to. We've been discussing with all these providers. There seems to be interest, but from a procurement standpoint, we can continue to keep you updated after this progresses.
No. Madam Chair, and I would appreciate that. You did mention, and I don't want to take up more of the committee's time, the buses. So when I've talked to some of the transportation network provider companies or the taxis, you know, they're going to have to make an investment in the buses. Is there an opportunity for them to purchase the buses as you phase them out of your fleet maintenance, or is that, would there be an issue with that?
Madam Chair, Representative, yep, the open bid auction, but actually, you know, we understand that some of the TNCs in Texas have stated clearly they will not provide accessible vehicles. So we were kind of talking about a design where we would be the complementary to that.
Okay.
So that we would have our providers have a certain number of accessible fleet that are for this same day on demand. It'll increase the cost, but it'll ensure that those with the mobility device have the same option available for on-demand as those who would use a TNC or taxi. So we're trying to think about how to do that with what the market has told us, but also what our customer needs are to not discriminate against one type of customer. So I think we have a option for that that would kind of fit both concerns.
Well, very good. And I just I'll close with thanking you for your presentation time today, Madam Chair. Appreciate that you brought this presentation to us. I think it's very helpful for me personally, but for the committee. And I appreciate the work that you've done and that we've worked together in the past. And pleased to have the governor's budget include the bill that we worked on to have the data sharing in there. I recognize the challenge in the transportation budget that this extending the service to my district, Lakeville, is a little bit of tougher one to do, but I appreciate that is in the transportation bill at the House here, so hopefully we can do both of those and appreciate your service today.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Mr. Hughes, would you like to approach the microphone? Please identify yourself for the record.
Yeah, Madam Chair, sorry. I know this was scheduled for 11:15 to conclude. Correct?
Okay, we have the room till 12:30, yeah, so I'm going to try to go over.
So
on this, it did say 12:30. So, okay.
I'm Mark Hughes, former member of the Minnesota State Council for 12 years. Joan Wilshire had me on there, served as general and then executive committee for a while. Chair Maslin, members of the committee, my name is Mark Hughes. Let me first start out saying that Nick Thompson did give a great presentation, but I want to bring up a couple things that I think are happening. And the drivers are, most of the time courteous. The fleet is well-maintained, that's true. But on January 4th, we had the biggest computer disaster you ever did see, whereby the Met Council computer and the Minute computer didn't communicate due to a bad switch. And it is true that most nights you can call and check on your ride if it's late. But the way the computers were set up was the phone system was hooked in the computer, so nobody could call. and the back has failed. And some of us were stranded 4 to 6 hours. That's also true. And this should never happen again. It should have never happened. Now they got the backups in. But again, we put the cart before the horse. The disaster happened before we had Plan B. So I went down and talked to Nora Slawick, and Christine Cannon was in the meeting. That was nice for her to come. And I've enjoyed talking to Christine through all these things. But there were surprises happened. In business, anything can happen. And I'm concerned that we're putting forth all this money first. And I really think that management has sometimes dropped the ball. And there are other things happening. We're going from my house to the Target Center, but we're going by way of Coon Rapids and Blaine. And I know it's a shared ride system. I missed one appointment over in Highland Park that I had to stay. I stayed on the same bus, and I went home by way of Shakopee. I live in Shoreview. I mean, this isn't efficient. You know, and some of these errors management has to take accountability for. And at the end of the day, the governor also has to take accountability. We've got to do something to make this more efficient and manage it better, and we have to do something more on time. You know, we're getting past winter. You won't believe it tomorrow, but we are going to get past winter sooner or later. And I just have some real concerns. It has to be managed. Thank you.
Thank you. Would you like to respond, Mr. Thompson?
Madam Chair, members, thank you. A little bit about, I don't know how much people know about the January 4th incident, but we did have a complete system outage and minute that took out both our main direct normal operations of Metro Mobility Service and our backup operations, and took out all Met Council systems. And so it was probably the worst case possibility that we have. And we did everything we could to communicate with our customers, but it took out all our communication networks. So we used the local media as much as we could in social media. We covered any trips that were the customers used to pay personal rides or taxis that they had. So we made sure that there was no financial burden, but it was the worst case scenario we've ever experienced for an outage. And we've got more redundancy in there, and but we, you know, the technology went down, our redundant pass went down, and we apologize for that, but it was a severe impact on some customers, and we acknowledge that.
Can I ask a question? No. Are you still using Minute for your main communication system?
Madam Chair, members, yes. Minute is our provider for the switches. The technology that failed on that day has been replaced. The redundancy path has been replaced, but they are one of our key, in the many components of our technology network, they are still instrumental in that, a piece of that, as they were before that.
Okay, and it's Minute that purchased the new system?
Yes.
Okay. Next, is there anybody that has questions of the...
Madam Chair,
Representative Elkins.
I'd like to ask some questions at the end, but
okay.
We can go ahead and continue.
Didn't Mr. Hughes leave?
Yes, he did leave.
Okay.
Oh, I mean,
I gotta go out and turn around. I'll be right back.
Okay. Was it of Mr. Hughes that you wanted
no,
to ask the questions?
Fine.
Oh, okay.
I
then
can wait till
why
the
don't
end.
You, what?
I can wait till the end if there are other people who need a test.
Oh, okay. In that case, I have Ms. Sheldon. If you will identify yourself and proceed, please. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Carrie Sheldon, and I am just here to testify on behalf of all the members, all the people that need Metro Mobility to get around, and there should be a better system for people to be able to get a hold of Metro Mobility and not have to sit and just wonder where their ride is. Because I understand that there it's really inefficient, and it's benefit inefficient for me because of the fact that, you know, there's meetings that we have to go to, there's doctor's appointments we have to go to, and we need to be able to get to places on time.
Thank you. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Mr. Thompson said that there is a telephone number that you can call all the time. So yeah. Is that, you're when, saying that's not working?
There have been times when I've been on the phone for maybe up to 5 minutes, and or the phone will just keep ringing, and nobody's there to answer the phone. And then it just... Waste a lot of times trying to get to make our rides for the next day, and we sometimes miss out on activities that we are needing to go to.
Mr. Thompson.
Madam Chair and members, that is a concern we hear about, our hold times on calls. And so it's something we monitor, and we increase staff as they go over time. One of our big initiatives that we want to do is have this online booking. With that would come an application that similar that you used to, if you can use a smartphone. Not all of our customers can't. I have that ability. But it would tell them where their bus is in real time. So we see some of those things coming. But if we can get the online booking, that is going to take a lot of pressure off the phone calls too, and so those that continue to need to use a phone to have a conversation, I think we're going to free up some of our capacity there. So it's one of our key priorities is to get that implemented. We've been trying to get that implemented for a while, and we hope that it goes online this year to address some of that concern that we do hear as the speaker spoke. This is something we've heard before, and we are trying to make improvements in that.
Thank you. The last person I have on my list is Heidi Myrie.
John Wilshire.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
If you'll state your name for the record and proceed, please. Thank you very much for
coming. Hi, my name is Heidi Meyer. I might sound like I'm repeating, but this is my assessment of what I see. Yeah, okay. I live in West St. Paul in Dakota County. I have been riding Metro Mobility for many years. Metro Mobility rides take me some places in the community to do some things like volunteering, seeing friends, shopping, medical appointments, and etc. Metro Mobility has some really good drivers that pick me up and take me home. Metro Mobility drivers have a set of things that they have to do when they pick me up, a person with a disability or a health condition, because that's in their website. Some Metro Mobility drivers will walk me to the bus or car, like they are supposed to make sure I am safe doing it. Some Metro Mobility drivers will walk me all the way to the door to make sure I get into the place safely, like they are supposed to. Remember, every person with a disability or health condition is different in how Metro Mobility drivers will help us. Some people use wheelchairs, scooters, and crutches, and I'm a crutch. So we all can be in the community going different places to do things. Metro Mobility Call Center has some good people that can set up our Metro Mobility rides so people that are qualified to use Metro Mobility can go places in the community. But more work needs to be done in the Metro Mobility Call Center in improving in how they set up Metro Mobility rides for people with disabilities or health conditions that are qualified to use Metro Mobility rides. And also improving the needs to be worked, and also improvements need to be worked on with Metro Mobility rides when they are running late, and who to talk to correctly to know when to be picked up in the daytime and nighttime for Metro Mobility. because what you guys don't know at night, we call the dispatcher, and the dispatcher puts you on hold, and you can be on a cell phone for up to 10 to 20 minutes. It's not even a joke, just to find out if they're running, why they're running behind. In the daytime, we have to call where we make the reservation person. And the reservation person says it can be a 30-minute wait. You know that after 30 minutes, it's considered a free ride, and it's a share ride. They don't always send you to the dispatcher, and they don't always know the accurate time of what the real truth is of when you're going to be picked up, you know, when they run behind. So there's got a lot of improvement. And if you have a processing problem, seriously, and you need things done in like 1, 2, 3, it's really hard to teach some of these people with disabilities how to set up a ride with Metro Mobility when the person on the other end doesn't follow a script. You know, like you guys have certain things you have to follow here at the Capitol. Why can't Metro Mobility so we can set up our rides correctly and know? Instead of some people hanging up the phone and finding somebody that knows how to set up the ride correctly. So that's a big concern of mine because I'm a big component of people with processing problems. And, you know, it's not just about wheelchairs, not just about the crutch, not just about walkers. It's also if you can process making the ride so you know you're going to A and B. Because how can I teach a client if they don't have consistency? So that's something we definitely need to work on. And just with the drivers, just remembering all the steps, because they have to ask for our ID. I mean, we have an ID because they're the reason for it, you know, for our safety. And remember to come to the doors and remembering to take us off correctly, you know, do all the So there are steps. I mean, Metro Mobility needs to do their part. At the same time, they're telling us to do our part. You know, be out there in 5 minutes when we get our phone call, do this, do that, you know. So, you know, if we don't show up, it's a no-show. So Metro Mobility needs to do their part. At the same time, we need to do our part so we can get along with each other. You know, and I can have the successful ride going to do my volunteer work, which I love to do. So I just want to pass that on. Thank you very much. Oh, and my ending, thank you for letting me talk today about Metro Mobility.
Okay, thank you. Does anyone have questions of this testifier before she leaves out of the table? Okay, looks like we have none. Ms. Welshire, if you can come to the table. And that looks like that might be a challenge.
No.
I don't think she was planning to testify.
Oh, you're not going to testify? Oh, okay, I apologize. I misread that. Okay. I believe that's the last testifier that I have on my list. Is there anyone else? If you would like to come to the table, please, and identify yourself.
Madam Chair, Honorable Representatives, my name is Tim Nolan, Senate District 65. I had some situations with Metro, about this briefly would qualify Metro Mobility. I was assaulted Veterans Day 2005. I had life-threatening injuries and all the procedures anyway. I was walking with a cane, but the situation currently is, the situation I've experienced is when I'm going for my appointments, there'll be an add-on. And then all of a sudden, like I was at the Mendota Bridge going out to cross town in 62, and all of a sudden the driver said, he said, I got to take a right. I said, why? You got to go straight. He said, you shut up till I figure this out. And anyway, I figured out they had him routing back to Invergrove Heights to pick up this woman and take her out to work. And I was just right on the squeak of time, but he was speeding on Crosstown to get me the appointment on time, and I was 1 minute late. But that's I have two different times at forums. I've expressed my concerns. It's usually about the time factor. I have a 5 minute window they have to give me, and I've waited up to an hour and a half. I had the ride was free. Then on the return, I waited almost 3.5 hours one time. And it's just, there's got to be some more. If they can't look at the big picture and say, I got an appointment here, appointment there. And I asked one of the drivers one time, what would you recommend? She said, I recommend that they get more sedans. Because I can ride comfortably in a sedan. I don't have to have the cutaway bus and so on. But I'm willing to discuss rather than waste anybody's time here on the committee. I'd love to get together with Mr. Thompson or somebody within their administration to kind of express some of the other situations. Because I drove limousine for 25 years, and I knew the city in the back of my hand. And also, as a mortician, I was responsible for our 50th Street Chapel and organizing transportation. The Humphrey funeral, my responsibility was to get all the U.S. Senate here and then get them back to Washington. And they wanted, but anyway, that's, I'm tooting my own horn in that one. But anyway, but it's just the frustration, I guess what I've heard said, is just the time waiting to get access to the system. I give high marks to the reservationist, but then whoever does the scheduling the following day, there's got to be some room. If I got three wheelchairs here and one here and not, they should have somebody that has that capability that knows how to coordinate the equipment in the proper places. And then like a sedan, could they pick up situations like myself and on. But I'm willing to meet with anybody in their management or Mr. Thompson. I'm going to be part of the discussion next week at Creekside on the, I believe is next whatever the day is. But overall, there's just some of the attitude of the drivers. One time I was on the way back, and I was getting close home, and all of a sudden I said, "Where are you going?" She said, "You shut up. I don't like backseat drivers." She was getting on the 35E, and I was going down the 7th and Smith. And it's just, I'm not being a backseat driver, but just I'm a little supercritical, because being all years of morticians, I did not have any wiggle room for any this. I had to be right the first time. And it's just, I know maybe I should just shut up and... But I have fixed the situation. I take the city bus now. I've increased my exercise regimen so I can go off on in Excelsior and walk up to my appointment. And I exercise at 15 more. I do my 15. I do it to 20 minute now. I can do a 16 minute walk up to my appointment. But I meet the criteria, and it's just I still qualify for matchability. And but I get that at discount rate, so I'm getting a heck of a bang for my dollar. So anyway. I hope it made some sense, but it's just the biggest frustration I've heard that I could rather say is the scheduling. The reservations give them high marks, but whoever does the scheduling, they got to know this is this way and this takes so many minutes and factoring in the weather conditions and all that stuff. But somebody that has that capability could be interviewed to have somebody on the staff that maybe has that capability. Okay, thank you again, Madam Chair and representatives.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions of this testifier?
No. Just,
okay.
It can be. I mean, is this the last testifier?
What?
Is this the last? This
is the last testifier that I'm aware of? Okay, so we'll come back to the table. And I do want to make a comment as well, because I do have a friend that uses Metro Mobility. And she thought she had solved the problem. She thinks no, but no human being ever looks at the schedule. And one of the examples that she had was happened recently where, and it was on a cold night, it was like 11 degrees. She was inside the building. A third person was supposed to be at a fast food restaurant. And there's a letter, I think that's what, you have the letter in your packet. The last person waited 40 minutes outside in 11 degrees weather because at the office that she was in, they just closed the door. And put her out, you know, so she had to be outside. So it seems to be a problem. So if you would like to kind of do that, and then we'll go with Representative Elkins.
Madam Chair, and we're sorry for that customer that had to wait outside. It's not something that is not a situation we'd like any of our customers to have. The way I think the scheduling to think about is today there's 9,000 rides. So last night, those 9,000 rides were scheduled, and so today we created 9,000 bus routes. And tomorrow we're going to create 4,000 bus routes because there'll be less trips, and there'll be totally different bus routes. And then during the day today, there'll be cancellations. There'll be trip add-ons, as mentioned, but it's really those 9,000 routes we created today change throughout the day, too. And it's a very big challenge that requires a system to actually do that with a human to have oversight over that. And so we do have a human part of that, but it's to meet all these performance targets, it's computerized real-time routing in a sense. And then when we hear persistent complaints, we look at the individual level to make sure no individual is experiencing repeated problems like that, and so we create exceptions, and then the managers dig into that routing of that individual to make sure that the system isn't doing something it shouldn't be. But it can be frustrating because that route is not a direct route. It is a route that is designed to pick up and share routes to try to meet those performance targets, and it can take you out of the way on that and change in real time based on somebody canceling a trip or adding a trip. So I know that's a point of frustration, but it's a very complicated routing that occurs every day when we're planning these bus routes. So,
okay. Well, the point with the letter was, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the dispatcher knows where these people are and what their situation is. So it would have been possible for that to tell the driver to pick up the person outside, even though the person, the other two people were inside. So,
yeah, Madam Chair, if that customer had called the dispatcher and let them know, then they would know. But they assume they're inside a building unless they've been told otherwise by a phone call. So I don't know in that specific question. We'll have to look into that. I can take that letter back and we can look at it.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think Mr. Thompson, you know, kind of addressed my main question. Is we know that the main frustration we hear expressed is, you know, related to the circuity of the routings. But, you know, this is a very complicated mathematical problem to solve, but it's, you know, pretty well understood, you know, how to solve it. And but I would guess, I guess this is a question, I'm guessing you've probably evaluated other, you know, routing software from other vendors, but it's hard for me to imagine that there would be another vendor who could solve this problem significantly better than the vendor that Metro Transit uses now. But do you look at that on a regular basis? Because that does seem to be the most persistent complaint.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we do. We're actually testing a new vendor now, but this is a very big system we're locked into, and the one we're testing now, they do not know if it can scale to this size. But what the new vendor is doing is some real time mapping. So they're using if there's delays, construction related, some congestion related, things that we're used to on a smartphone. Isn't in our existing system, and so we definitely want to test and push our current vendor to modernize another system, but I think that'll be incremental improvements at best to this complex challenge. It's just
mathematically a very difficult problem to solve, and a human being can't really do it any better than a computer can do it. The other question I had, Madam Chair, would be that I know a couple of years ago the Met Council authorized the service providers to increase their wages by $2 an hour in order to improve. The other big complaint I used to field was people with standing orders who have a regular ride every day see much better service when they can have the same rider every day as well. So has that improved now, the turnover and the ability to recruit drivers since the wage increase?
Chair, Representative, yes, we increased the wage from a $14 base to $16 minimum, and that is really improve the quality of our applicant pool for drivers, and then our retention. And retention is the big thing. So they cut their drivers stay, they get familiar with the customers, and then they start following all the procedures we require. And so we have heard from customers that has helped the situation quite a bit. But there's still a lot of pressure on finding good drivers and retaining them. I think that pressure is going to exist for a while.
And then just one last question, Mr. Chair, is related to the routing thing again. I gather that since there is a service level standard for onboard time, that must be one of the constraints that you can enter into the routing system?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that is a constraint for the maximum onboard time, and something we look at. And then if there's a violation, we have exception reporting and ways to deal with that. But yes, it's onboard time relative to what that trip would be for a fixed route. Uh-huh. But of course, sometimes these fixed routes are very long times, and so we have onboard time can be acceptable from a performance standard point, but maybe is not it's definitely not desirable from a customer standpoint sometimes.
I would receive complaints from people who had trouble controlling their bodily systems when the ride would stretch out to over an hour.
Mr. Johnson.
We hear that, and that's something that what the requirements are is maybe not what the customer expectation is. We are required to meet the requirements, but we definitely want to try to reduce that on board time as much as possible.
Any other questions? Let me give one more example that of a constituent. Now she wanted to go to a grocery store, which max would be a 10-minute drive. She was picked up by the driver, crossed the river, and they dropped somebody off at the Mega Mall. Then they came back across the river and then took her to the grocery store. And again, part of the complaints that I keep hearing is it's about efficiency. And again, shouldn't she have been picked up on the way back from the Mall of America rather than having her, picking her up, taking her there, and then bringing her back, which I think that trip to the grocery store, she said, took her six hours that day.
Madam Chair, that
she was tired.
That is a frustration. So that contractor in that situation met all the contract goals because their system said, I have these two riders, and I have to meet. One has an appointment, say, at 4 o'clock, and one has 4:15. I have to deliver both of those within the windows provided, and in order to meet both of their trips and meet them, that trip made sense from a routing standpoint. From a customer standpoint, it probably made no sense to either customer. And so we try to not have those, but those occur because of the shared ride. If it was just a individual ride scenario, like driving to the grocery store, it'd be a very different model, but that is just not the model that the service is designed around. And that could be a point of frustration. And we're definitely open to ways to change that, but I have to be honest that in order to change that, it requires a bigger system to meet less onboard time. And that's just a financial question, in essence. So.
Okay. We're at 1:45, and I think at this point, unless there are questions, I will consider calling adjourning the meeting. And my guess is we probably have more questions, but we'll leave that to another time. But thank you, everyone, for coming and for testifying. You have a good day. Meeting is adjourned.